Hi, I'm Ann DeLisi, the host of the Essential Conversations podcast series. What you're about to hear is my conversation with rock drummer, co-founder of Sonic Boom Records, president of Beggars Group US, and author Nabil Ayers. His book, My Life in the Sunshine, was published on June 7, 2022, and is about his complicated relationship or non-relationship with his famous father, vibraphonist Roy Ayers. During this interview, we talk about his history as a musician, being the president of a label, and discovering the family he never knew he had. We recorded this interview at Third Man Records in Detroit in front of an audience on October 19, 2023. The interview was pressed directly to vinyl that night. Here's my conversation with Nabil Ayers.
Okay, Nabil, we're going to start with some of the fun stuff first.
All right.
And the fact that you're a rock and roll drummer. But you started playing when you were 2 years old.
Yeah.
Do you remember the feeling? This probably goes back a long way, but do you remember the feeling of hitting a drum for the first time?
I think I do. I write about it in the book. I mean, I was playing, you know, I was the kid that was playing pots and pans and, like, you know, hitting everything, so I'm told. And so my uncle, my mother's younger brother, who's my father figure, bought me a real drum set, not like a fancy one, but like an adult-sized drum set when I was 2.5. And I think I remember him bringing it to our apartment. We lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I remember him coming down the stairs with each drum one at a time. I don't remember hitting a drum. I remember hitting the hi-hat cymbals and hearing, like, being really surprised by how loud it was and how long it lasted. And that's the first sort of hitting a drum memory I have.
You carried a drum, you carried a cymbal with you. And I want you to talk about why you did that.
I mean, I wanted people to know I was a drummer. A lot of my childhood pictures are me, like, walking around the streets of New York and Amherst with tons of pictures with drumsticks. And I don't know if there's a cymbal picture, but my favorite thing to carry was a cymbal, which was, you know, huge for a 3 or 4 year old or whatever I was. But it was, there's no better badge of being a drummer than carrying a cymbal around. It's more obvious than drumsticks. So I think I realized that.
You know, you and I talked earlier, and we save this question for now. I think that the drums are the most seductive instrument because anybody walking by a drum kit thinks they can sit down and play. Like, you don't walk by a saxophone and go, you know what, I think I can do that. You walk by a drum kit, you're like, I'm going to sit there and do that. What do you think about that?
It's true. I mean, and especially being a drummer and, you know, playing in clubs and places around the world for years, there's always someone who's like, oh, or let me sit down and I know a song. And you know, you don't, like you say, you don't see people do that on guitar because guitar is really hard until it becomes less hard. But like it doesn't feel natural. I think drums feel natural and I think drums are natural. And that's probably why people are drawn to them, because you can hit a drum once and it sounds like a drum. Mm-hmm. And that feels good. It's rewarding.
Did you ever think you would play anything else, or was that it for you? You played guitar.
I play guitar, but I never thought, it's weird. It's not that I didn't think I was good enough or couldn't be good enough. That was certainly part of it. But I think I don't think I have the type of brain that is artistic and creative, and maybe those aren't the right words, but enough to be a songwriter and to come up with things. I always felt like I was much better at playing along with things and doing so creatively and artistically. I'm not discounting that. But when I played guitar in bands in college, and I just always felt like when I saw other guitar players, I always thought, like, I'm never going to be able to do that. And not the playing part, but the being in it and the emotional and this is what I'm doing part. But when I saw other drummers, I always thought, oh, I can do that. I'll be better than that person.
Did you ever want to be out front?
No, but then I wrote a book, which is like, you know, the most, the analogy I make is now I'm the singer and the songwriter and the only person in the band.
Yeah. Exactly. Do you still play?
I don't play drums. I live in Brooklyn in an apartment with my wife. You know, there's not a drum set in the apartment. I have two. I have one at a friend's place in Nashville and another in LA, but I don't, and it drives me crazy every day. I air drum all the time.
So what does that look like?
I mean, there's no music on. There usually has to be music on. It looks like, you know, yeah, we're not.
You
can't see this on vinyl, but yeah. I look really cool.
He looks right so now. Great. Yeah. You said you go to sleep doing that too, right?
Yeah, it's often, I do it when I'm going to sleep, and it's how I tell myself that I'm waking up. So if I wake up really early and I think, like, I don't need to be up yet, if I start feeling it, I know I'm awake because I'm playing drums. Yeah.
It's got to be hard to not play then.
Yeah.
It's got to be really hard to
I'll
not play.
I'll play again.
So to that point, I want to go to three instances that you talk about in the book. And I want you to describe what those instances are. I'm just going to say pogo stick, 5K race, and playing the timpani. Because those, all those moments, you follow it with the feeling of being noticed and having all eyes on you and how you love that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk about those three instances in your life?
Yeah, that's funny you went to those. I mean, the first one when I was maybe 7 or 8 years old and was a kid in Amherst, somehow I got a pogo stick and realized like, oh, I could do this forever, and almost did 2,000 jumps on my pogo stick. And I was doing it for so long that someone, it was a small town, obviously, someone called the newspaper. They came out, they sent a photographer. It's a real small town, 70s stuff. And the next day, I was on the front page. We still have the clipping of the Amherst record. It's a picture of me on the pogo stick. And, you know, it wasn't a world record or anything, but it was a slow news day. And the way I talk about it in the book and in my life is like the next day, people are like, hey, it's the kid from the newspaper. There, I saw you, all that. And I loved that. I loved that more than the pogo sticking, which I think I was just doing for fun, I think. But of course, once the crowd started to draw, it was probably like, oh, it's even more fun now.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the second incident?
The 5K race.
5K race. So yeah, when I was probably 10 or 11, I started running. I always loved to run, but my mother said you should start doing these sort of organized races every week. And I think I, you know, won my age group 1 week and got a trophy or a ribbon or something like that. And again, they called my name and I was up on the pedestal and people clapped and I realized like, oh, wow, I like this feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the final one?
The timpani.
The timpani. That's a different one to me because I lived in Salt Lake City for a long time in high school and we had a neighbor, a good friend, still good friends with, who was the timpani player, you know, the huge whatever kettle drum in the Utah Symphony, and there's this amazing, like, huge, beautiful symphony hall in Salt Lake City, and he took me there one time when it was empty, when he was just practicing or tuning his drums, and I got up on stage with this, you know, huge, crazy, beautiful theater and hit the drum, and I was already a drummer, so it wasn't that first hit thing, but the idea that it just, like, rang out everywhere, it was really, really powerful, sort of how loud it was and how, I think that was almost more of a like power moment than an attention moment because there wasn't an audience, but these things are all connected, yes.
So when you finally, so we'll talk about the fact that rock music was your thing. Let's talk about Kiss for a second. And
I would love to. I mean, I can't not make a reference to Detroit Rock City, right, while we're here. Yeah.
It's always a good thing. As you started to play, you know, your father was a completely different genre, but you did have the drive that he had. You guys shared that, the desire to make music all the time. But it was rock music that really was your sweet spot for playing. So Kiss had a big influence on you. Can you talk about that?
Huge, yeah. I mean, I remember, you know, my uncle's a jazz saxophone player. My mother is a ballet dancer, not a musician, but very musical. And they both had big record collections. I was exposed to so much music from an early age, lots of jazz. And then when I was 5 years old, I saw the Kiss Destroyer album sitting on the shelf at the UMass Amherst bookstore and just thought like, well, that's what's that? And I think I was probably familiar with the Kiss imagery at the time, but not with the music, but insisted that we buy it. And we did. And I just became completely obsessed with it. It changed everything. All the jazz, all the much better music went out the window. And all I wanted to do was play along to Kiss records, put on Kiss makeup, which my mother did all the time. There's lots of great pictures of me with like a really lumpy hippie afro that I used to have and Peter Criss makeup on my face. And that's all I wanted to do. I just wanted to be in Kiss. And there's another component to it. It was the being a biracial kid with a black father and a white mother. Even at that age, I think I didn't, I would look at the Beatles record and think like, I don't look like those guys, so I don't know if I'm going to be able to do what they do. And I thought the same thing with Stevie Wonder records. And I kind of thought like, I'm in between. And Kiss, weirdly for me, obviously I knew they were white guys from New York, but the makeup and the idea that anyone could look like them really did open a door for me.
That's really interesting. I mean, throughout the whole book, you talk about where you're going to fit in, that mm-hmm. it was, and it's interesting because when you were really young, it was not a good consideration.
Right.
And then as you start to grow up, then you become so self-aware, you know, and that's when everything started to change for you. But it was a consideration at every juncture, like every social situation. Mm-hmm. Talk about what that felt like, and do you still deal with that now?
Yeah, it's really started to happen. I mean, for my first 10 years, I lived in New York City and Amherst, Massachusetts, and in particularly truly diverse, idyllic communities in those cities, where there were so many kids of different races and different backgrounds, lots of kids with a single mother like me. So I was really a totally normal kid. And then we moved to Salt Lake City, where I was, you know, not suddenly, we really didn't fit in. Lots of kids asked if they could touch my afro and what my name meant and all these things that I didn't even think were that mean or racist necessarily. It was just really hard to suddenly have that at 10 years old. And that's when I think started to become really protective. And the question I ask myself now that I don't talk a lot in the book is about all the times when I thought about that, meaning like every time, you know, I had a normal high school experience. I had friends and I was popular and I went to the prom and those things. But when I went to pick up my date for the prom, who was always a white girl, because that's what there are in Salt Lake City, I would show up and I'd be really, really nervous. And the reason I was nervous was, is her mother going to look at me and say, I think Julie's feeling sick tonight? Or is her little brother going to say, there's a black guy in the house? Like, these were all real considerations that were going through my head every time I walked to the door. It never happened, but I spent a lot of energy sort of preparing for it to happen and worrying that it might happen. And that still goes on. I mean, less in my life now. I live in New York City. I'm more confident the world is maybe a better place. I don't know. But definitely in high school and very much so in bands, touring America was always really scary.
You have some really interesting stories about touring the United States.
Yeah.
And as a rock musician and in your bands, can you tell a story about something that sticks out in particular? Well, there's a couple of them that were defining moments for you.
Well, going to jail was a big one.
Okay, that's a good one. Okay, yeah. We'll go with that one.
And I'm glad I can laugh about it now because it ended up okay because I'm here. But I was in a band called The Lemons, this rock band in Seattle. This would have been like 1995, a long time ago, when pot was very illegal in Washington and every state at the time. And we were doing a six-week tour of America, and two of the guys in the band really liked to smoke pot. They didn't want to deal with trying to find it every night in different cities, so they brought 3.5 ounces with them, which is a lot, I'm told. And we got pulled over like 2 days into the tour in the middle of the desert in Utah, somewhere between Las Vegas and Salt Lake City. And it was pretty crazy. It was like guys in army fatigues with big guns and dogs running around the van and all these things. And they found it. And the next thing I know, I'm handcuffed behind my back on my knees in the desert. All of us are handcuffed in a row. It's felony possession with intent to distribute, which in 1995 could have meant like prison time. It's like a real thing. We went to jail that day. We got mugshots. We got fingerprinted, the whole thing. And they let us, it got really weird. They let us finish the tour. It was a really small town, and they said like, okay, you guys will come back. We had this like, look, this is what we do for a living. I think they also thought we were famous, which helped. We weren't. So they let us do this tour, and we did this whole tour under the fear that when the tour ended, we were going to court and we might be going to prison, which was, it was a really, really dark tour. I remember it wasn't very fun. We didn't want to tell anybody for all these reasons. It was terrible. And because I'd grown up in Salt Lake City and had a lot of connections there and good friends, and it's a small town, we hired this guy who was the top criminal attorney in the state, and we paid him $10,000, which felt like a ton, and he absolutely made it go away. Like, it was gone. We had to go to court, and they dismissed us. I have a stack of paperwork. I still have it. I scanned it, that says, if anyone ever asks, you can honestly say you've never been arrested. We're sorry. This never happened. It's crazy. And to me, I mean, there's two takeaways. It's like, it's scary how much trouble you can get in for something that now doesn't really mean that much. Mm-hmm. And it's also scary that if you know people and have money, you can just get out of it. And that still exists.
That's a great story. But let's talk about the things that you had to deal with looking different than everyone else in the band.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when we would drive around, especially in America, less so in Europe, we would pull up to a gas station and everyone would get out and be like, I'm going to get a sandwich or whatever. And I would sit there and kind of look around and think like, there's four bald guys hanging out over that big car. I wonder if there's any reason they might not like me and if I should not walk over there. And I remember once looking out and seeing a guy with a big swastika tattoo on his chest and just thinking, I'm just staying in the van. I'll just hold in my pee for the next couple hours. I'm not getting out. And my bandmates just never, I don't think they even knew that. And I didn't talk about it. I think maybe I didn't even want to be a burden, or I didn't want to be like the sort of the difficult guy in the band we have to think about. And I don't think they would have treated me that way, but I think at 23, that's what I thought. So yeah, I think it was a lot different and a lot harder for me. And I was really, really careful, which I think is probably good, but I still do sometimes wonder if I was too careful and spent too much time
thinking about
worrying.
Yeah. Let's get back to drumming for a second. One of the things that you said, which I never considered, not a drummer, is being the person to start the song. And that feeling, talk about that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's still the best. But I realized that early on, I think when I was in sort of the first band of capable musicians, if that makes sense. I was always trying to start bands from like 2 years old. But when I was in junior high school in Salt Lake City, finally there was a kid that could play guitar and a kid that could play bass. And we got together in one of their basements and learned like a few punk rock covers. And that feeling of like, and everyone coming in and being like, oh, I just started that. And this is how albums, this is how shows work. Like someone does that and I'm the person doing that. And if I want it to go faster, I'll just play a little faster. Like there, I have this, you know, because I'd been playing along with records. That's how I learned to play drums. I didn't take drum lessons. I wasn't doing rudiments and exercises. I was just putting on my headphones and playing along to Kiss records. But I didn't have any of that control with the record. So this was this crazy real life version of playing along with a record.
Lowell Tolhurst from The Cure talks about how all drummers are friends. Is that, talk about that. Is there any truth to that?
I mean, there must be. I met him through another drummer friend, Joe Wong, who has an amazing podcast called The Trap Set, which was drummers only for the first 200 episodes, I think, and now is open to others. And Joe brought Lowell from The Cure to a book event I did in California, and we became friends. And I just hosted Lowell's book event a few weeks ago. He just had his second book come out, which is great. And I told, because that's what he wrote on his book that he gave to me. And so I brought it up in our conversation. And he just launched into this whole thing about Budgie from Susie and the Banshees and how they were hanging out in Los Angeles once. And Tommy Lee showed up and suddenly we're doing this. And there's this story about a drummer and another drummer and another drummer. And I wish I was hanging out that night. But I do think there is sort of a kinship among drummers. And maybe it's the least respected musician in the rock band sometimes.
You think so?
I think so. I mean, there are more drummer jokes than there are guitar or bass player jokes.
One of the things you and I talked about earlier today was playing to get good. And you deal with a lot of bands now. You are a label president. And it was as simple as if you don't have control over anything else that's going on, you have control over that one thing.
Yeah.
Playing to get good.
Yeah. It's obviously easier for me to say now as someone who's the president of a label and not driving around in a van playing shows. But as much as, you know, and it's always been like, there's always been some version of, why can't I get on the radio? Why can't I be in this Spotify playlist? Why don't I have a New York Times feature? Whatever it is, there's always some version of that. You can't control that. What you can control is playing as much as you can and getting really, really good at what you do. And doing that, especially if you do it in a live setting, you'll meet more people. You'll meet other bands that you play with that open for you, that you open for. And in a couple of years, you'll be so much better than you were. And I think I just wish more people focused on that than on the sort of immediate, how can I get lucky thing.
Are you able to say that to musicians?
Yeah, I say it a lot to musicians I don't work with who ask me for advice all the time. I mean, I'm lucky that most of the musicians I work with are extremely, extremely hardworking. That's how they've gotten to the point they've gotten to, or they've figured out the balance. And so sometimes it's not about, not everyone wants to be huge. Some people want to have good lives and, you know, be ambitious while also not throwing themselves completely into that. So a lot of it's about balance.
Okay, so you you're an accomplished musician. You know what it's like to tour the country in a van and all the pains and all the disappointments and all the excitement that goes along with being in a band. And then you become the president of the coolest label ever, 4AD.
Yeah.
A job you tried to not get after they pursue you. Like, your friend's like, what are you doing?
Right.
They're not going to ask you. When you finally said yes, why did you finally say yes? Because you basically said, I don't ever want a real job. And this was a real job,
right,
with a lot of responsibility. And you had done, I mean, we should mention that you had a very successful record stores. You knew how to deal with labels. You knew how to do marketing. You knew how to play. You knew what it was like to basically manage a band and a group of creative people.
Right.
All of that you have to do to run a label, but you still were not convinced that you were the right person for that.
Yeah, I think I still just thought that there was like this magic special sauce that labels and label people had that I didn't have, because I was this sort of this entrepreneurial person, which I viewed as a great thing. That wasn't that I was ashamed of that in any way. I just thought I had a totally different set of skills and a different career track because I really never worked for anyone. I had plenty of like high school jobs delivering pizzas and washing dishes, but after college, I worked in a record store, I played in bands, I owned a record store and put out records by my friends. And in my head, that didn't qualify me to have this real job where people worked for me and where I had a boss that I was accountable to, and most importantly, would be like involved in the careers of some of people who I thought were the best bands in the world, truly, music I loved and respected. So I was really scared, and it kind of came up in a backwards way where I was at a party and ran into someone who worked at Beggars, which is the parent company over 4AD and a few other great labels, and I was telling him, like, I just moved to New York. I'm so excited. I'm not going to try to get a job. I'm working on my own label. I'm managing a band. I'm doing all these things. And the next day he called and said, you know, I know you're not looking for a job, but 4AD is looking for somebody in New York. I'm not the person hiring, but I can put you in touch. And I was just terrified because I just thought, like, they'll know if I talk to these people, they'll know that I can't do this. But ultimately I did. And Simon, who became my boss, we just hit it off and we sat for 2 hours at lunch. He never saw my resume. We just talked about music and talked about all these things we had in common. And I think that conversation is what really solidified it for me. It wasn't a job interview. It was a conversation with someone who I had so much in common with that made me think, like, oh, wow, maybe I can do this.
What surprised you the most about having that job?
That there's no special sauce. I think after about 6 months or a year, I realized in both good ways and bad that, especially, you know, because running a record store and playing in bands, I was always analyzing. I always had this kind of business brain, and I would think, like, why is this working? Why are the Shins so big? I like the Shins, but why are they so much bigger than these other bands that I like that aren't? What are they doing that's different? I try to analyze it, and I always assumed, well, there's some secrets. There's something someone's doing back there. And I learned that there wasn't. I mean, I think in the case of the Shins, or I know a lot of people who worked with that band at Sub Pop, but at 4AD, it was just people with really good taste who had connections and contacts and experience and great relationships and the ability and a brand who could sort of push it out and get it to people. And not everything worked, which is also part of what made me realize there wasn't a secret when things that were great didn't work.
What does it feel like to have a certain responsibility over the trajectory of somebody else's creative journey?
It's hard. I mean, I do think in a good way, in sort of this modern record label age, I had less influence than I would have at a label in the 80s or 90s, where it was really the label was king, the band better do what the label said, you're gonna go do this tour, you're gonna go do the radio interview. I think that sort of old school record label thing ceased to exist and never existed in my world. And that was also another surprise when I realized, oh wow, these bands, they say no to things, they do what they want, they do what they're comfortable doing, they don't always do stuff, and they're still successful and on their own terms. And that really impressed me and still really impresses me because that's still very much a thing.
Mm-hmm. As a radio person, I don't know what it feels like to hear your music on the radio. I just play the stuff. And at one point you talked about hearing your music on the radio for the first time, which is now what you're trying to get these bands to do. Talk about what that feels like.
As a musician hearing, I mean, the first time I was in a band in college, and there was a great college station in Tacoma, Washington, and we had a song that they played like crazy. And I remember, I think I was driving, maybe I was in my friend's car. Either way, I was in a car, we're coming around a corner in Tacoma. I remember the exact corner, and suddenly it came on, and it was, I played guitar in this band, and the song begins with guitar, which means I was trying to be a drummer in that band. And I just remember, like, it feels fake the first time. It's like, am I imagining this? Is somebody in the back seat with a CD? This can't the first thing for me was like three different reasons it couldn't actually be happening. And then the click that it is really magical and crazy.
And now you're trying to get that for your bands. And now you get to go watch them perform, be there, watch them build their careers, help to build their careers, get them on the radio. What is it like to watch a band break? And have a part in that.
I mean, you know where we're going with this. We just talked about it for a moment. But the example that comes to mind is Future Islands, band from Baltimore. I mean, well, to answer the question quickly, it's really incredible. And it's fun. And it's not super ego-y for me now. I think maybe because I was in a band. I certainly feel a personal connection, but I don't feel like I did this. But with Future Islands, what was so fun about them is they'd already released a few albums on a smaller label. They weren't that big of a band, but they'd toured a ton. They'd played hundreds of shows, and our publicist was able to get them on the David Letterman show. This is a while ago, in 2014. And that was a huge thing for a not very big band at the time. The album was going to come out in a couple of weeks, so it was great timing. And they played, and I was there. A few of us were there. And halfway through the song, we all just realized, and I've been to plenty of TV tapings, and we all looked at each other. We were like, something's happening. This is like a crazy moment. And it turned out to be, I still don't know why. It was just an incredible performance. People really reacted to the singer, Sam Herring, and identified with him. And it spread like crazy the next day. And Bono and Foo Fighters and everyone was tweeting about it. But it really made their career and put them in this sort of next level thing. And they got every festival that year. But I remember thinking, I'm trying to think what my connection to it was. I mean, I think our publicist probably felt more excited than I did because she literally booked the thing. But I felt like I'm part of this. And also there's this, it's part of the drive thing where it was the opposite of like, we did it. It was like, wow, there is so much more to do now. And it's going to be so fun. And people are going to be so much more receptive to it because now we have this thing and this moment to build on.
All right, we're going to turn our attention to why you wrote this book. So this is a very personal story about your relationship with your father. And one of the things that I said to you when we talked the other night was, we are defined in many ways by the relationships we have, but we're also defined by the relationships we don't have. And that is really what your story is how much influence a man that was never part of your life had on you, and how much energy and thought and heartache was surrounded by somebody who wasn't there. So now you're out here talking about this, and you wrote this book, and why did you write it? It comes from a lot of painful things.
Yeah.
But why did you decide it was time to tell this story and be so public about it?
I still don't have a great answer for that question, or I don't have a really easy, quick one. I started writing a lot for fun 6 or 7 years ago. I think I was in my 40s. I wasn't playing music anymore. There's definitely a creative itch that was scratching, and it was just fun. I was writing about going to jail and playing in bands and having a record store and all these things. And my wife said, this is all great. You need to write about your father and your race because that's what you care about. Mm-hmm. And I knew she had a great point. And I also was really scared because it was, you know, I could write about Sonic Boom, my store in Seattle, and people loved it and it would make people happy. But this was the opposite. I'd had to write, and the idea of writing about somebody I didn't know. And so at the time, I just thought, I should do that. I'm so into writing right now. It wasn't an assignment. She didn't say, and send me something in 2 weeks. So in my head, there was nobody that was expecting me to do anything. And that allowed me to do it with complete freedom and honesty. And I really just started writing about every time I'd met him, about what it feels like to hear his song when I walk into a room, or that movie scene I think I wrote probably around then. And eventually I'd written a lot and I realized, wow, there's stuff here from like age 0 to age 42, I wonder if I could be writing a book. And I really kind of tricked myself. And by that point, I'd written a lot. And it was so honest, but I really thought, like, well, I could take things out. No one needs to see this. I'm just going to keep working on it. So it didn't come from, I'm going to try to write a book. And I don't think that would have worked. It came from, I'm just going to try to get all this stuff out. And it turned into a book.
So we should establish the relationship between your mother and your father before we continue any further. Can you talk quickly about their relationship and then how you got to where you are?
Yeah, when my mother was 20, she met my father. She was with my uncle. They were at a jazz club in New York City. My uncle had met my father a couple times, and so the three of them were talking, and my mother, and I'm very close with her, and she's alive and well, she said to herself, this is the person I'm going to have my child with. Not this is the person I'm going to marry, or this is the person I want to be with, but it's all about the child. And they dated 3 times over the course of a year. And the third time she said, I want to have your child. You don't need to be part of our lives. And he agreed. So I've always known this. There's no divorce. There's no he left us. He was always talked about in very positive terms. If he came up when I was a kid, it wasn't, oh, your deadbeat dad, or he doesn't send us money. I never heard anything like that. It was, he's a wonderful, talented guy, and he gave us you.
We should talk about how your mother created an amazing world for you as a single mother, and certainly your uncle created this beautiful life for you, but still, meeting your father was never a fulfilling experience except once, maybe.
Right.
That one lunch.
Mm-hmm.
It was the only time where he actually gave you something, I guess, that was meaningful. It gave you hope, which probably was a cruel joke in the end, you know, because nothing ever came of that. Do you know if your father has read your book? Do you know if he knows about it?
I don't know. I assume he knows about it. I'd be really surprised if he doesn't, because I know people who know him or people who talk to him. And so no one's told me anything specific, but I haven't heard from him or the members of his family, my family, who I'm not in touch with. So I don't know. And that doesn't surprise me. I didn't expect him to get in touch after this came out. And that certainly wasn't the goal.
Mm-hmm.
But I really don't know.
Do you feel like you healed in some way writing this book?
So
can you talk
much.
About that?
Yeah, I think there is a specific moment where I think I figured out that happened. And it was really when I was seeing, I wrote about this, not in the book, but later. The book had just gotten finished, and Summer of Soul, that movie was about to come out, incredible movie. And I went to a screening with a friend of mine a few days before it was released at this park, at the park where the movie or the concerts happened. And I knew it was 1969. So in my head, but something like that, I always think, is my father going to be there, or is he going to be in the movie? Like, those are the things that go through my head. But to me, 1969 meant, oh no, he was, you know, he's more of a 70s guy. He won't be part of this. And then 20 minutes into the movie, and this is at this huge screening, so this giant screen, and suddenly he's there, he's playing, it says Roy Ayers on the screen in huge letters. And from the reading I just did, where at the beginning of the book I have this moment in the movie theater where I hear his song, and it really sends me into the state of panic and I feel terrible. And when this happened at the Summer of Soul screening and I saw him, I was almost expecting that, and it didn't happen. I got this crazy feeling of pride, and I remember thinking, like, wow, this is so different. I'm so surprised. Part of it was footage I'd never seen, and it was really good footage. And I had this weird moment where I thought, you couldn't be that good and do anything else. That was one of the first things that kicked into my head, that, like, I'm not surprised he was so hyper-focused on this, because you have to be to do what he's doing right now. But it was also just the idea that I think I just turned in the book and my editor just said, we're done. And I think that was a 3.5-year process where I went through a lot and thought a lot and wrote a lot. And it got me to this point where I could see him on a screen and think, like, wow, I'm proud. I leaned over to my friend and I said, that's my father, which I've never done.
Wow. One of the things that you talk about is the journey of discovering a family you never knew. I mean, we could talk about nature and nurture. You know, you had a family, quote unquote family, with all of these people that surrounded you,
right?
Which is amazing. And they loved you. And, you know, you had this family that was created almost by your mother and your uncle. But then as you start you're a curious person and you are tenacious. The steps that you went through to find out about your family on your father's side was really incredible. It sounds like you had another job doing nothing but that. But one of the things that struck me is how you saw yourself in these people. Like, you look a lot like your father.
Mm-hmm.
You guys have the same, that smile. Pretty undeniable. But you end up meeting members of his side of the family, and you look like them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is like when you're an adult. So this is like you grew up with these people. All of a sudden, there's this family that you never knew you had. Can you talk about getting in contact with them and what that felt like? Because they accepted you, too. That's another thing.
Right.
That could have gone badly, I suppose.
But
it didn't. Talk about what that felt like to finally connect with these family members you never knew.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, what happened is I finally had lunch with my father when I was about 35. I decided he's getting older. So am I. It's a good time to at least get some family history or some medical history. And it was great. It was really connective. And I thought, oh, great, we'll be able to do this once or twice a year. But when I tried to get in touch with him, he obviously wasn't into that, and he wouldn't call me back, or he'd be really quick on the phone. And so that's the first time I finally got angry with him and finally felt, I think, what people assumed I'd been feeling my whole life but hadn't. So I decided, I don't need him, but I still need all this information. I'm going to go around him. And it's a very long story, but I did 23andMe and learned a ton from that. Got a copy of the Ayers family tree on that side of the family, and that connected me with all these other people, and many of whom were first cousins. I mean, suddenly I was in touch with my father's sister's daughter and her family, and my father's other sister, who unfortunately passed away last year, but who I got to spend a lot of time with. And then I have pictures of the first time I met them all. We went to lunch in Los Angeles, and it was really powerful to sit at a table with all these people, even the next generation, these kids who are in their 20s. We all look exactly alike. And I've never had that on my father's side at all. Never met anyone except for him briefly. So it was really a wild thing to have happen in my 40s.
Do you have good relationships with them now?
Yeah. I see most of them when I go to Los Angeles. We text, we talk, we text on holidays. My aunt, I'm so sad, she died last year, but she took me to the cemetery to meet my grandparents, her parents, which was a really powerful moment.
And she introduces you to them.
Yeah.
Which is really something in the book.
Yeah.
I won't go into that, but it was really something in the book. Do you want a relationship with your father?
I don't know. I mean, I think I have one, but the question might be, do I want a different relationship with your father? Because it's really strange. To me, there's this parallel with the song, with how I feel about him, and I have a relationship with the song, Everybody Loves the Sunshine. I don't know. I mean, people have asked me if suddenly he were to just call me and say, hey, I want to get together. I really don't know what I would do. I'm not sure. And it's not in a begrudging way, but I've gone through such a sort of range of emotions over the last 15 years, and I feel really good right now. And I think I might view that as selfish on his part and maybe wanting something more than wanting to give something, but that's just what's in my head. So I lean towards no, but I can only say that hypothetically. I don't know what it would actually feel like.
That's my conversation with Nabil Ayers. My thanks to Third Man Records for hosting us. Find out more about his book and his life at NabilAyers.com. To hear other essential conversations, visit WDET.org. I'm Ann DeLisi.